In Jamaica, Hurricane Melissa has passed, but the long work of recovery is just beginning.
Many places are still very difficult to reach, and communications are very difficult. Cell service is down. There isn't power. There isn't running water.
I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Food security for Jamaicans is also a major concern. In Tanzania, deadly demonstrations have been fueled by charges of vote rigging.
Whether you win by rigging or whether you win by disqualifying your opponents, it's still a way of rigging an election.
Also today, remembering a tragedy in Serbia and a luxury hotel in Afghanistan that sat through a lot of the country's recent history.
The wealthy tourist who would glide across the marble floor on the way to the swimming pool. It oozed a life of privilege and ease.
All that and more today on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for joining us on this Monday. People in Jamaica are starting the slow process of recovery after Hurricane Melissa tore through the island nation. Officials say that 28 people are confirmed dead, though that number is expected to rise. At a news conference late last week, Jamaica's education minister, Dana Morris-Dixon, said the government is prepared to mobilize billions of Jamaican dollars for the response effort.
We have to have all cabinet ministers with all hands on deck to treat with this. We have never had a Category 5 hurricane in our country. The devastation on the West is unimaginable.
Hurricane Melissa was especially merciless for the country's agricultural sector. It wiped out crops and livestock, fueling concern about a food shortage. Linda Roth is with World Central Kitchen. The group is providing food aid in Jamaica. She returned from a visit to the island's western provinces earlier this morning and told us what she saw there.
There's a wide swath of damage in the triangle between Montego Bay, Negril, and Black River. You see all the landscape is brown. The trees are stripped of their leaves. There's flooding, lots of power lines down, and widespread roof and infrastructure damage in those areas.
And how much has the agriculture sector been impacted in those areas?
It's really hard to tell. I can't speculate on that. Many places are still very difficult to reach, and communications are very difficult. Cell service is down. There isn't power. There isn't running water. And so I think it still remains to be seen.
Yeah, I read that assessments would be completed maybe this week. Then we'll know more. Are there food shortages on the island right now?
So humanitarian aid is pouring in. As you mentioned, I'm at the Kingston Airport. Water tankers are coming in. MREs are coming in. Black beans, rice, all the staples of a Jamaican diet are coming in, and helicopters are going out to the western parishes every hour.
Your organization specifically tries to source as much as possible from the island. You mentioned staples being flown in, like black beans. Are those not available on the island?
They are. We're just preparing to cook hundreds of thousands of meals here. We're working with over 38 Jamaican restaurant partners. This is Jamaicans serving Jamaicans, and so we are trying to use all the local resources that we can, and so far we've been able to deliver over 100,000 meals in the past week, and we are building our own kitchen in Montego Bay, also using local ingredients, and we hope to cook 70,000 meals a day out of that kitchen. So we're bringing in reinforcements. Mm.
And so all those meals, the food is still largely being sourced from Jamaica?
Yes. Most of our restaurant suppliers, fortunately, are located in Kingston. That's how they can keep producing and creating these food, thousands of meals that we're serving. And they are just happy to be able to support the people on the western half of the island over here.
What was the state of food security in Jamaica before this storm? I know there was some damage to food production with Hurricane Beryl just last year. Was there a lot of food insecurity in Jamaica before this hurricane hit?
Well, a lot of the hardest reach areas, which World Central Kitchen is reaching by helicopter, are some of the more rural areas that traditionally are more modest here in Jamaica. So I think right now everybody is looking for a comforting meal, and we are giving them out to whoever needs one.
Are you hearing stories from people who are coming for food about what conditions are like for them right now?
So most people in that area I described between Negril, Black River, and Montego Bay, there's no running water. So World Central Kitchen is also giving out water, fresh fruit. We're trying to focus on handheld foods so that they're easy to distribute and easy for people to come in and eat. But so many areas are cut off. We visited one area yesterday by helicopter that was cut off by a landslide, Spring Mount in the St. James Parish. And we also reached Savannah La Mar by air, and they're going to need daily food drops to continue for sure.
Those communities that you reached via helicopter, was that the first aid that was able to get into those areas?
I'm not sure. World Central Kitchen is trying to reach as many areas as we can, but we're finding that the food is disappearing within 15 minutes. So definitely there is great need all across these Western parishes in Jamaica.
Is there a sense of how long there will be a need for World Central Kitchen to be there?
World Central Kitchen likes to say we'll stay as long as you need us until you don't anymore. This was a very devastating storm that devastated a lot of this country, half of it, and I expect there'll be need for quite a while.
Linda Roth is with World Central Kitchen. She joined us from the airport in Jamaica's capital, Kingston.
In Tanzania, President Samia Hassan was sworn in for a second term today. Unlike previous swearing-in ceremonies, this one took place at a military base, with members of the general public not allowed to attend. The event was live-streamed by KTN News Kenya. Beyond the ceremony, Tanzania's government has imposed an internet blackout. Still, some videos of opposition protests have surfaced in recent days. Critics of Hassan's government point to reports saying that several hundred people have been killed during demonstrations. Daniel Padgett tracks Tanzania's elections and politics. He's an assistant professor at the University of Sussex in the UK. To start with, Daniel, the government in Tanzania says Samia Hassan won the recent election with 98% of the vote. How credible is that claim?
I think it's unlikely that she won with 98% of the votes. Ultimately, we can't tell because none of the monitoring bodies were allowed to monitor the elections and we have no reliable third parties. However, even if she had won the election and by a margin, whether that one or a smaller one, ultimately she won by keeping her two foremost opponents off the ballot altogether. Tundu Lissu is currently facing charges of treason in high courts. Her other principal opponent, Luhaga Mpina, was kept out of the race on technicalities. So whether you win by rigging or whether you win by disqualifying your opponents, it's still a way of rigging an election.
There's also some suspicious evidence, witnesses saying polling stations were mostly empty on election day, and yet electoral authorities say turnout had been 87%. What does that tell you?
Well, it tells me alone that if these figures were true, then it would be among the best attended of all Tanzanian elections. It sounds to me like it's a fabricated election results. And this Putin-style, practically 100% of the votes statistics gives you that alone, I think.
So in the run-up to the election, Amnesty International said Hassan's government carried out a reign of terror. That was their phrase, a reign of terror against the political opposition. What do you know about that?
So I think that's a fair description, and there are many forms that terror has taken. So I've already mentioned Tundu Lissu's treason trial, but the leading opposition party, Chadema, says that in the last few weeks alone, it has accounted for 50 or so of its members and activists that have been abducted, disappeared, arrested or killed. There's a long history of this sort of extrajudicial violence, kidnapping, killings of political opponents in Tanzania, but the scale's different. I've never seen it taking place on this scale before. We are in uncharted territory in Tanzania.
So how significant are the current protests? I mean, we've seen some estimates ranging from 10 dead to up to 800.
Yes, and Marco, it seems very likely now that soon there will be higher estimates. There are reports of mass graves. There are reports of bodies being taken off the streets and reports of the dead being disappeared from hospitals. It's hard to verify these things, and that's deliberate. Verification is being obstructed by a regime which has resorted to mass violence to stay in power and is now trying to clean up the evidence. You asked about how significant the protests are. There have never been protests like this in Tanzania. There have never been protests that are so widespread across the nation or as violent. I think to find an equivalent, one might have to go back to the struggle against British colonial rule at the turn of the 1960s. But even then, the protests were not as violent and they were not cracked down upon the same levels of violence. I imagine to find a true parallel of a rebellion with this much violence involved, one might have to go back to the Maji Maji rebellion against German colonialism at the beginning of the 20th century.
That's pretty extraordinary. Can we just take a moment and talk about President Samia Hassan and what she's done and is doing? Like, what issues in Tanzania did she promise to address in her last term, and what kind of job did she do?
Well, she took over from her predecessor, President Magufuli, who died in office in the spring of 2021 in March. So she promised that she would simultaneously honor Magufuli's legacy. And there are ways in which she might claim to have done that in keeping up an anti-corruption campaign and focusing on big infrastructure projects. But she also promised reform, and heavily implicit in that was, no, in fact, it was explicit, was democratic reform, that she would re-democratize Tanzania. And she offered a number of token steps in that direction early on. She unbanned some media outlets. She released some political prisoners. And more widely, there was what you might think of as a good governance turn, more committees, more adherence to COVID and public health good policy. However, more widely, the substance of that promised reform program never came out. What Hassan did with that reform program was make out that there would be this great train of democratic reform coming around down the track. And she offered those token down payments, but the train never arrived.
Well, indeed. I mean, what you've been describing more recently does not sound like reform. What sort of opposition is there left in Tanzania to challenge her rule?
Honestly, that is a question I continually ask myself as an observer of Tanzanian politics. It's ever so hard to tell because there are very few opinion surveys, and those that are permitted offer at best a murky lens onto the truth because people are careful what they say in an autocratic state. There is certainly a very well organized and a dynamic opposition. The leading opposition party is known as Chadema. Tundu Lissu is its leader, and they've been approaching this election demanding constitutional reform. In fact, the movement at large that is alive in these protests has made its chief demands for what one might think of as a series of human rights and democracy-related issues. They want an independent electoral committee. They want strong protections for freedom of speech. They want the right to gather in protests again. They want a less imperial presidency. Mm. I was genuinely surprised about the scale of the protests that broke out. In my experience, the opposition and the anti-autocratic movement in Tanzania keeps on surprising. It keeps on coming back, even when it seems like things are hopeless.
Daniel, why should people pay attention to Tanzania going forward?
Tanzania is at an inflection point. The sort of autocratic regime in effect in Tanzania is changing. It's becoming more like some of the other autocratic regimes in the region that are facing a mass Gen Z protest. That aside, Tanzania is the fifth largest country in Africa. It's got over 60 million people in. It's bigger than the United Kingdom, than Italy. It's a large country, and the things that are going on there are tragic and human, and they matter.
Daniel Paget follows politics in Tanzania closely. He's with the University of Sussex in the UK.
Just ahead, what happens to the global system of refugee resettlement when the U.S. steps back from taking people in? You are listening to The World. The This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. The Trump administration has announced a dramatic cut to America's refugee program. For this fiscal year, the White House is setting a cap of 7,500 refugees total. That is the lowest number in U.S. history. In addition, almost all of the people being granted refugee status this year will be white Afrikaners from South Africa. By way of comparison, the Biden administration set out to resettle a total of 125,000 refugees during its final year in office. To understand the global impact of this decision, we reached out to Krish O'Mara Vignaraja. She's the head of Global Refuge, one of the 10 agencies here in the U.S. that helps with refugee resettlement.
Those who come through refugee resettlement go through extreme vetting. CIA, Interpol, Department of Homeland Security, FBI. They have interviews. They have health clearances. They have to receive exit clearances. These are the most extremely vetted immigrants who come to the U.S. It is why it is a years-long process. And it is also reflected in the fact that only 1% of refugees ever get resettled in their lifetime.
So are there people who have already been through most of that process, those background checks, interviews, medical exams, who now will not be allowed into the U.S.? Like, what happens to people in the middle of this process right now?
So when the administration announced a pause on refugee resettlement, it meant there were thousands of families and individuals who were in the pipeline, who had gone through every hoop, checked off every box we'd asked of them. They had gotten approved. They had plane tickets in hand, and even those flights were canceled. The status of those approved refugees remains in legal limbo. There was a lawsuit that went through the Federal District Court in Seattle, which decided that there should be a special master to adjudicate which of these families would be allowed to come to the U.S. And unfortunately, the Ninth Circuit overturned that ruling. And so it is very sad when you think of how many qualified families who followed the legal pathway, who, you know, came the right way, who are now still stuck in countries with their lives at risk.
And so now are our new people just not going to be vetted if the number has been shrunk so much?
So what it means is we have people, families, young children who are vulnerable, who remain in ongoing crises in places like Sudan, Afghanistan, Venezuela, Ukraine, the Democratic Republic of Congo. Today, there are 42.7 million refugees worldwide. And so the idea of reducing the number of refugees who can be admitted, but also focusing that limited number on a certain demographic is incredibly hard-hitting to some of the most vulnerable people around the world.
I want to talk about the global picture here for a second. I'm curious how many refugees the U.S. has taken in historically in terms of the overall share of refugees globally.
Since 1975, the U.S. has resettled over 3 million refugees. We have taken in more refugees than any other country. So for decades, U.S. refugee policy has set the tone for the international community. And historically speaking, when we lead, others step up. When we withdraw, others step back. In fact, we've seen this movie before. After the U.S. slashed admissions in 2017, during President Trump's first term, resettlement by other countries fell by 25% in just 1 year. So this isn't just about what happens within our borders. It's about cascading effects on global stability, on allied nations already hosting millions of displaced people, and on the message we send about moral leadership in a time of crisis. And it's a troubling message because obviously no single nation can solve a global displacement crisis. But if the world's most prosperous nation won't lead by example, then who will?
And that 25% drop globally, you see that as cause and effect in reaction to the U.S., not other things?
Absolutely. Now, that's not to say that other countries haven't done their part. Countries like Turkey and Jordan, who are experiencing regional instability, have actually bore a significant part of the responsibility as a result of the proximity. But certainly what the U.S. does, other countries take very close note of.
So would you expect to see other countries maybe boost the number of refugees that they are accepting in reaction to the U.S. reducing its numbers?
I wish that we might see other countries step in when we step back. But unfortunately, the ripple effect has really been seeing other nations follow the U.S. in retreating from its humanitarian obligations. Where we've seen an exception is on economic visas, where when the U.S. is a more hostile environment in terms of filling shortages of labor, other countries pounce because they realize it's an opportunity.
I want to talk about the push factors that are leading people to seek refugee status. How are the forces that are driving refugees out of their homes, how are they changing?
Around the world, we are seeing unprecedented mass migration. If you include internally displaced people, we have 123 million people around the world who are facing circumstances that forced their migration. These are people who are fleeing civil war, religious persecution, the crises that have been going on in Ukraine and Venezuela. But on top of that, we are seeing migration as a result of the climate crisis. By 2050, we will actually expect 216 million people to be displaced. And by some account, that's actually a conservative estimate. If you ask Al Gore, he would put that number at a billion.
Of course, those people are not covered by the refugee program.
Exactly.
As you said, we've seen this movie before. The refugee numbers were cut during the last Trump administration. They were boosted back up again under Biden. Do you expect to see any long-term impact from this year's reduction in refugee resettlement numbers in the U.S.?
To the extent that you cut the numbers to such bare bones, there's got to be an expectation that you are dismantling the infrastructure. And this is an infrastructure that has been built up over four decades. When you see a new refugee cap of only 7,500, it doesn't align with our history or our hope for the future, but it really does mean that it will break the system down.
Krish O'Mara Vignaraja is the head of Global Refuge based in Baltimore.
The Maldives are known for aquamarine waters lapping at the sandy shores of island atolls. The country off the Indian coast will now be known for something else. It's the only nation to enact a generational ban on tobacco. That means prohibiting sales to people born after a certain date in perpetuity. In the Maldives, that means anyone born after January 1st, 2007 will never be able to legally buy or use tobacco there. The health ministry says the goal is to protect public health and promote a tobacco-free generation.
The ban applies to all forms of tobacco. Selling tobacco to anyone underage now comes with a fine equal to $3,200. The new rule applies to tourists, too. The archipelago is known as a luxury tourism destination. Previously, New Zealand was the first country to attempt a generational law against smoking. It passed in 2023, but then it was repealed less than a year later.
The latest on the strong earthquake in Afghanistan is just ahead, and later, an important symbol of recent Afghan history, Kabul's storied luxury hotel. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Afghanistan was hit by a powerful earthquake overnight. The 6.0 magnitude quake killed at least 20 people and injured hundreds more. Homes, roads, and other infrastructure was destroyed or damaged. The World's Shireen Jafari has been following the immediate aftermath.
It hit in the northern parts of the country, a city called Mazar-e-Sharif in Balkh province. We're still getting details about the destruction and deaths and injuries, but earlier today I spoke with Dr. Hossam Faisal. He's the head of the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies in Kabul. He told me that rescue teams are already on the ground and providing survivors with temporary shelter and other basic necessities. He also explained, Marco, why this earthquake had so much impact on the houses in that area.
The buildings are built using very basic techniques. Of course, that affects more the impact and increases more the impact of the earthquake on those households.
So what he's talking about there is that a lot of the structures in Afghanistan are not built with strong material. Think things like mud and wood. And so every time an earthquake hits, there's a lot of damage in these areas.
Understood. Now, I've heard that one of the iconic cultural structures in this part of Afghanistan was also damaged.
Yes, that would be the Blue Mosque in Mazar-e-Sharif. And it's one of Afghanistan's top religious sites. It's believed to be the burial place of Imam Ali, the son-in-law of Prophet Muhammad. And Marco, when you see it up close, it's a stunning mosque with blue and turquoise tiles that have Arabic calligraphy hand-painted on them. And people go there to pay their respects and pray. And today, a Taliban spokesperson posted a video of that mosque, and it showed some rubble in the courtyard, and it showed some damage to the walls of the mosque.
To your eyes, did it look as if it might be able to be repaired?
It wasn't totally destroyed, so yes, it can be repaired, but Afghanistan is going through a lot right now, and we will have to see whether this is going to be a priority for the government or not.
Now, Shirin, there was another quake just 2 months ago, that one also about the same intensity, 6.3 magnitude, that one. Is there an explanation for what's going on?
Yes, and in fact, there was another earthquake last year. So yeah, Afghanistan does get a lot of earthquakes simply because it sits on active fault lines. What makes these earthquakes even more deadly, Marco, is that even though the government knows that earthquakes happen in the country, it doesn't do much to prepare for them. It doesn't strengthen buildings, and it doesn't prepare the communities, raise awareness about what to do. And often these earthquakes happen at night, like this most recent one, and people are asleep and they don't have time to move to safety. That's why they can be so deadly. Afghanistan is also a big country and with a lot of mountains and remote areas. So when natural disasters happen, it can take a long time for rescue workers to reach these locations.
So Afghanistan relied a lot on international aid before the Taliban took power. Is it getting international support now in the wake of these quakes?
So after the fall of the U.S.-backed government in Afghanistan in 2021, a lot of the NGOs and aid groups that worked in Afghanistan left. The new government, the Taliban, has been very restrictive. For example, it doesn't allow Afghan women to work for foreign NGOs. And some of these aid groups left Afghanistan because they just didn't want to work with this new government, the Taliban. But some are operating in the country and they are providing aid and support. The U.S., which used to provide about 40% of Afghanistan's aid, has cut nearly all of its funding and support.
Wow. So as you pointed out, Shirin, these natural disasters leave a long-term impact on communities. Besides the immediate toll and loss of life, what are you hearing about how Afghans are actually processing these earthquakes one after another?
You know, Marco, it's devastating for these communities. Besides the immediate shock, these families have to deal with what comes next, the burial of their loved ones, and then survival. That part of Afghanistan in the north gets really cold during the winter, and there's a lot of snow. So the immediate question is, how are they going to survive the winter? Then, additionally, the Afghan economy has been decimated by years of war. And in 2024, the UN estimated that about 85% of the population in Afghanistan lives on less than $1 a day.
Wow.
Take a moment to let that sink in. So for many people, their houses and their homes is basically the only asset that they possess. And once that's gone, it will take them years to rebuild, if they can rebuild at all. And this is what Hossam Faisal, the head of the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies in Kabul, told me about how these communities are trying to get by.
The coping mechanism and resources are already overstretched. The community solidarity is one of the key elements in those contexts where they support each other.
So, you know, neighbors coming to help another neighbor. But Faisal emphasized that these communities still need outside help to survive.
The world's Shirin Jafari bringing us the news on the latest earthquake to hit Afghanistan. Shirin, thank you very much for your reporting.
You're welcome, Marco.
We're staying in Afghanistan for our next story, a far cry from the modest houses Shirin was describing. We're going to the first modern luxury hotel in Afghanistan. It's perched high on a hill overlooking the capital, Kabul, with sweeping views of the Hindu Kush Mountains. When the Hotel Intercontinental opened in 1969, some called it a bubble above the cares of the city. In its heyday, it was a gathering place for diplomats, well-heeled foreigners, and affluent travelers. But over the years, political turmoil took a toll on the grand five-star establishment.
A lot of the rooms had no working toilet. The ceilings had collapsed. The windows were just plastic with bits of masting tape.
That's Canadian journalist Lise Doucette, who knows the Hotel Intercontinental well. From London, she spoke with me about her new book, The Finest Hotel in Kabul, A People's History of Afghanistan.
Just after 1979, when Soviet tanks rumbled in, then a lot of the guests came from friendly countries in the Soviet bloc, the Revolutionary Brothers and Sisters. When the Mujahideen came to power, these were the Western-backed rebels who overthrew the Soviet-backed government. Remember that? It was the Cold War days. It was in many ways right. The Ukraine war of our time, the most grievous war in the world. But when the Mujahideen took over the hotel, then the hotel guests were other fighters, friends of the Mujahideen, including people from Pakistan, people from Iran, people from the Arab world. And then came the Taliban. Their guests, well, Pakistanis and Arab guests, and the most famous one of all, Osama bin Laden.
So who would be hanging out in its lobby?
After the fall of the Taliban in 2001, everything went through the lobby because the world came to Afghanistan's door. And the Intercon was far from being a luxury hotel then, but it was still the finest in town. You had wannabe Democrats, you had female parliamentarians, you had people of goodwill from the world over. They all went back and forth into that lobby. And they were all, I can remember so vividly, all around that big buffet table. And boy, were the plots hatched and lots of gossip and conspiring went through that hotel.
I want to come back to this because this is kind of the era that you knew of. I mean, you first checked into this hotel in 1988, but going back to the early 70s when the hotel first opened, we see photos today of that era, men in sports coats and ties, women carrying school books and short skirts, driving cars. But that heyday of the Intercon was not really part of the world of the main characters in your book, was it?
What really struck me was what pride they took, most of all by those who had been trained by the proper Intercontinental. And the oldest character in the book, 70-some-year-old Hazrat, he still carries himself with the bearing of an Intercontinental waiter. And then he became a housekeeper. And he remembers those days. And what a privilege it was. He saw it wasn't his world. The first story he told me, but he even mimicked the gesture of the wealthy tourist who would fling a white, soft, plush towel across their shoulders and glide across the marble floor on the way to the swimming pool. It oozed a life of privilege and ease that was not his life, or indeed a lot of the people who worked in the hotel, except, of course, for the royals. It really was a different world, but they found their place in that world. In fact, to a person, especially those who'd worked there for decades, and many had, they said they saw it as their second home.
You tell the story of Muhammad Aka, who worked his way up from busboy to head waiter over several decades and negotiated multiple changes of regimes in Afghanistan, from the Soviets through the Taliban 1.0 and then 2.0. So what sort of skills did he draw on to do that?
Every time the rulers changed, the rules changed at the Intercontinental. When the Mujahideen came to power, they had to keep their black waiter's jacket and trousers and black tie locked away, and they came to work in the traditional Afghan clothing. They grew a beard. They wore a turban. They had to stop serving alcohol. There was no music as a backdrop. And when I would talk to them about politics, and of course I had to be very careful not to put their lives at risk, they had their own views, but when it came to the hotel, they had a job there and they did their job.
Yeah, so under the Taliban, it was still a status job, but you just couldn't be proud of it publicly, it sounds like.
When the Taliban came to power, they smashed the music systems. They took the alcohol that was in the basement, and then tanks rumbled over it to make a very public display of destroying it. There were difficult days. And, you know, I describe the monotony of those days when there weren't many hotel guests. There wasn't that buzz of guests coming in and coming out and celebrations by the pool. They just had to listen to the clock tick down until the end of their shift. Just to hold on to a job was a big achievement. And in fact, in the worst years of the civil war of the 1990s, the Mujahideen leaders couldn't pay them. And the staff couldn't even get to work because it was so dangerous, because it was a turf war between the competing armed groups. And so a lot of them had to just stay at home and make do, literally make do. Mm. Hazrat, who went from being an intercontinental train waiter to putting together matchboxes at home with his children.
The hotel never closed its doors, you write, even during the collapse of the Afghan government in August of 2021. What was that moment like at the Intercon?
It was a moment of excitement for the Taliban, who surged up the hill. This was a big tourist attraction for them because the would-be suicide bombers had heard about this hotel, which had been bombed spectacularly by the Taliban in 2011 and 2018. And they saw it as having been a den of their enemies, of the infidels. And they came in confrontation with the 20-somethings who were working at the hotel, who had lived through those suicide bombings, who lost their loved ones. And so, Marco, it was this amazing moment where you had the young men in their 20s who'd lived under American bombs and American raids on their villages, confronting the young men and women in the hotel who had grown up in a system of international engagement, of aspiring for a Western education, even to travel to the West. And so this was really, let us say, a moment of reckoning.
How many times, Lise, do you think you stayed at the Intercon in Kabul? Like, in total, are we talking months or years?
I started in 1988 and stayed nearly a year. I went back time and again. I was there in 1992 when the Soviet-backed government was toppled. I went back again during the Civil War. I didn't get there during the Taliban days, but it was a place to stay after the Taliban were toppled and the two decades of international engagement began.
Were there times when you were glad you were not there?
There was one moment when I was living at the hotel for months on end in 1989. It was the summer after the Soviet troops had pulled out, and more than 100 rockets were falling on the city a day, fired by the Western-backed Mujahideen. And of course, the hotel was high on a hill, but it never hit the hotel except that week when myself and another journalist who was staying there, John Burns of the New York Times, we decided to make a trip to the other side, to Pakistan, to see the war from the side of the Mujahideen, and a rocket slammed in to the first floor of the hotel.
Mm. What is the Intercon like today? I mean, is it still a kind of archive of national memory, or does it pretty much undergo regular renovation with each regime and the past is erased?
Your listeners can go on to booking.com or however you book your travel. The Intercontinental Kabul is open for business. You'll see photographs of the gorgeous buffet offerings in the main restaurant. You'll see the luscious cakes in the cafe and the rooms. They don't mention there's no music. Don't bring your bikini. There's no cocktails. And it is run by the Taliban. But it is a hotel, and Afghanistan is more peaceful because the Taliban have stopped their suicide attacks.
You've seen so much of the world, Lise, conflict zones, disaster zones, and you've stayed in a wide range of accommodations, some of which play very important roles in their cities. What is it, do you think, about certain hotels that allow them to be actual players in writing their country's history?
In focusing on this hotel, Marco, I was trying to tell what I hope is an everyday kind of story, which allowed me to tell the story of lives lived in the hardships of war, but a life where people still find hope and humor. They still live for joy. The kind of lives that all of us lead. We get up in the morning, have a cup of tea or coffee, and find an everyday courage to face the day.
Lise Doucette's new book is The Finest Hotel in Kabul, A People's History of Afghanistan. Longtime listeners will also know her as the BBC's chief international correspondent. Let's take a look at a few other international headlines we're following today. India is celebrating a major victory in women's cricket, taking home the World Cup trophy after years of just coming up short. The biggest win on cricket's biggest stage is expected to push the women's game into overdrive. India's newest champions pay tribute to the women who paved the way for them. The trophy was passed around to previous Indian players who came to watch the historic victory.
Voters in Montreal voted for change in yesterday's mayoral election, choosing Soraya Martinez-Ferrada with 43% of the vote. Her opponent's party had held the mayor's office for 8 years. The CBC reports Ferrada arrived in Montreal as a child when her family fled the Pinochet regime in Chile. Among the mayor-elect's promises, to audit the city's network of bike paths and use new approaches for housing and homelessness.
And congratulations are in order for humans reaching a milestone in space. This weekend marked 25 continuous years of people living off of planet Earth, specifically at the International Space Station. The ISS has welcomed nearly 300 people since it first opened the hatch on November 2nd, 2000. The orbiting research outpost is winding down its role. The International Space Station is set to be decommissioned in 5 years. More news is on our website, theworld.org, and you'll find us on all the socials as well.
We head to Serbia just ahead, where people are not giving up on holding their government accountable for a deadly disaster 1 year ago. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. It's been 1 year since a disaster at a railway station in Serbia killed 16 people. On Saturday in the northern city of Novi Sad, tens of thousands of people gathered to commemorate the tragedy. Over the past 12 months, public anger has grown and sparked some of the country's biggest protests in decades. Many Serbians say government corruption led to the disaster last year, and they are calling for early elections. The World's Europe correspondent Orla Berry has more.
2 weeks ago, students set out from Novi Pazar, a town in southern Serbia, and started a long walk towards Novi Sad in the north. It's a 211-mile trek. They called it the 16 Days for 16 People March. What motivated us is our need for justice and our frustration with the arrogance of government officials, Ines Hojic, one of the marchers, says. On Saturday, the students reached Novi Sad, where tens of thousands more had gathered. A year ago, on November 1st, the canopy of the newly renovated train station in the city collapsed. Those who died were aged between 6 and 77. On Saturday at 11:52 a.m., the exact time of the collapse, the crowd went silent. There were 16 minutes of silence for the 16 people who died.
That is a feeling that can hardly be described.
Student Milutin Milanic walked for 2 days from Belgrade, the capital, to Novi Sad to be there.
When you only hear dog barks in long distance for the first minute, but then even that goes silent, and the only thing you hear are a dozen drones that are high up in the air, recording the whole thing.
The protesters say the tragedy is down to government corruption during the renovation of the station building. An independent investigative team reporting to the EU Parliament found that high-level state graft had led to poor construction standards and that unqualified subcontractors were hired to work on the project. Helena Ivanov in Belgrade says for many, the roof collapse was the final straw.
The last 13 years of rule of the Serbian Progressive Party have been, you know, marked by corruption, by democratic backsliding, by an increasingly tighter and tighter grip that President Vucic holds. And I think the citizens are simply tired of living in a country like that.
Ivanov is a research fellow with the Henry Jackson Society, a UK-based think tank.
They want to live in a country that's more democratic. They want to live in a country where they have freedom of press. They want to live in a country where they have rule of law. And they want to live in a country in which corruption doesn't kill.
Serbian President Aleksandar Vucic has dismissed those corruption allegations. He often refers to the protesters as terrorists. On Friday, in a TV address, though, he appeared to change his tune.
Mnogi u našem društvu pravili su ozbiljne i velike greške.
Many in our society have made serious and big mistakes, including me, he said. In some moments, I myself have said some things that I regret saying. Filip Balunović, a media and communications professor at the University of Belgrade, who was in Novi Sad for the commemoration, says nobody is buying the president's apology.
He reminds me actually of these violent men in in marriage, right? You beat someone and then you're playing nice for a couple of days, then you apologize, etc. And then you beat again.
13 people have been charged in relation to the disaster, but so far no one has been prosecuted. Student protesters say they're not convinced anyone will be held to account while Vučić is in power, and that's why they're calling for early elections. Yesterday, President Vučić agreed to a national vote, but he refused to confirm a date. Balunović says the president must be feeling the heat.
I don't think he can handle this for too much longer. Also, economically, the country is in crisis. The first impressions were if he waits long enough, then people will get tired. But it didn't happen. I mean, the opposite happened.
But even if elections go ahead, many doubt they'll be free or fair. Slađana Komatina is with the Centre for Free Elections and Democracy in Serbia.
We have a lot of issues with electoral conditions in Serbia in the last more than 10 years, and the spotlight is back on electoral conditions and the question of media access and media conditions.
Vučić still commands support, particularly among older generations. But Komatina says it's hard to really gauge his support because most of the polls are biased. Protester Miljutin Miljanic tells me he doesn't expect the elections to be free and fair either.
My generation, the students that are fighting for justice, have not witnessed or remember fair elections. We will have to fight for our voices and votes to be heard and counted. The elections will not be fair, but we have to win in those circumstances.
In the meantime, Miljanic says the protests will continue. Yesterday, Diana Harka, a mother whose son died in the disaster, began a hunger strike outside the Parliament building in Belgrade. I must know who killed my child, she said. Someone must be held accountable for this. For the World, I'm Orla Barry.
It's barely been 2 days since the Los Angeles Dodgers eked out a Game 7 victory over the Toronto Blue Jays. But this World Series is already part of baseball lore. It's being talked about as one of the greatest endings in one of the greatest World Series ever.
There's also the undeniable Japan factor. Baseball fans in Tokyo erupted in elation when the Dodgers got the final out for the big win. Japan's attention, and everyone's, frankly, was already on LA's one and only Shohei Ohtani, arguably one of the best players in baseball history. But it was a different Japanese pitcher, Yoshinobu Yamamoto, who really stole the show. He was on the mound for that final out.
Yamamoto had already pitched a rare complete game earlier in the series, and then he went on to pitch in Game 6 and 7. This never happens in Major League Baseball. The gutsy back-to-back performances easily earned Yamamoto the MVP of the series.
The superlatives in this nail-biter series between LA and Toronto are backed by endless stats, of course. Baseball cannot get enough of stats. But the emotions of fans also tell the story. A Tokyo cab driver told the Associated Press, "I am so proud to be Japanese today." He pulled his taxi over to watch Game 7 go into extra innings.
And speaking of stats, Game 1 and 2 of the World Series averaged nearly 11 million viewers in Japan. It's safe to say that Game 7 probably eclipsed that.
The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you right here tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. and by FJC, a foundation of philanthropic funds serving the nonprofit sector with donor-advised funds, fiscal sponsorship, bridge lending, and more. FJC.org. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. More information at theworld.org.